Blog Talk Radio.
Carol the Coach. Sex, love, and relationships. We talk about it here.
Carol the Coach. Compassion with contemporary relevance.
I am a psychotherapist. I can be your personal life coach, and I can help you with your issues. There are no problems too small or too big. You can talk about anything.
Speaker, columnist, radio TV host, and commentator. Carol the Coach brings messages of wellness and empowerment within reach of everyday people every day.
Almost 5 years ago, I lost my soulmate in an accident. He was killed in a plane crash. Life just for me has seemed to stop.
There are groups all over the city. I mean, I teach one. It is a specific way to start thinking so that you shift how you see the world, which then shifts your energy, and then you feel better and you actually see things differently.
Carol the Coach. Always available to at carolthecoach.com.
Now I've got Russell on the line.
I'm 47 years old. I'm a truck driver. I'm married. I have a wife in San Francisco.
Okay.
I haven't been home in 6 months. My thing is, I don't know if I have a sex addiction or what the problem is. Why do I want what I can't have? And as soon as I can have it, I don't want it anymore.
You're right on target when you say, I don't know if I have a sexual addiction. Well, guess what? Yes, you do. And you know what? That's my specialty, Russell. So you're at the right place. Continue.
I meet women online, and I'm in a different part of the country. I travel all 48 states, so I love sex.
I hear self-esteem issues. You never felt good enough, and you didn't feel like you were getting what you should have then, and you're reenacting that now. Do you want to change that about yourself? You can watch it.
And you know, that is the question. Do you want to change your behaviors? You know, it's not about willpower, and it certainly is not about desire. It is about creating a structure to make that happen. And unfortunately, so many of the sex addicts that I work with, they want so badly to make their life different, but they forget to do two things. They forget to actually understand and work with their feelings. And when that occurs, what ends up transpiring is that you can't be authentic and genuine unless you know what your feelings are. So much of my therapy and much of my group work is identifying all the different feelings. Then in addition to that, that's when you can be more authentic, trustworthy, genuine, and you can make the changes you need to make. However, that second component is equally important. It has to do with that action plan. It has to do with setting up the structure to make your life different. Okay, what does that mean? That means that what you really have to do is create a system that supports you in your recovery. Now, this goes for addicts and partners alike, because sometimes I'm working with the partners and they're doing a fabulous job. They've got it down. They're going to their 12-step meetings. They're working hard. They are doing everything that they need to get sober, to get recovered. Now, that's not a one-time deal. That is a lifelong process. And then the partners of the sex addicts are so wounded, so traumatized, they have an overabundance of feelings. And as a result, what ends up happening? They don't work a recovery program, and so they don't get healthier. So for the partners, it requires the same thing. You need a support group. You need to do your reading. You need to meditate. You need to get to a good, qualified, certified sexual addictions therapist. And I know you know this. If you don't know how to find one, then you have to go to www.sexhelp.com, put in your zip code, and find out who is the closest person for you. And if you don't have a CSAT, a Certified Sexual Addictions Therapist, then look for one that does some Skype. You know, I do consultations, and there are many of us that do. We'll work with you to get you started on the right road. More and more often, therapists are actually doing Skype sessions. However, there's a lot of legality to that. So I would much rather say I'm going to act as your consultant. I'm going to get you to the right places. We're going to work together to find you the right support groups. I'm going to give you the right readings. I'm going to show you the recovery tools. And then it's up to you to use the supports and the system that are available to you in your town or city. Now, I got to tell you that it is hard work to do this work. And yet what I know to be true is when you do the work, not only does it work, but you end up being a better person than you were before you started. So the good news is you become the new and improved, and you probably wouldn't have been that new and improved had you not had the addiction or had you not been married or dating the addict. Now, would I wish this on anybody? Of course not. But what I know to be true is that it does really work on your character. It helps to heal some of the wounds. You know, so much of sexual addiction is about trauma. You've heard me talk about the big T's and the little T's, the big traumas and the little traumas. And, you know, for somebody who was molested, whether you be an addict or whether you be the partner, you might not have worked on that stuff if it hadn't come to fruition with this problem. So there's always some good that comes out of the pain, and there's always some positive that comes out of the rain. And, you know, my saying that actually rhymes is that sex addicts carry the shame, while partners of sex addicts carry the pain. Now, that doesn't mean sex addicts don't have pain, but truly, tonight we're going to be talking about feelings and about the pain, the shame, the guilt, and, of course, how to bring that all back, work through it, and make your life different. So I'm going to be talking with Ken Howard, and he actually is an amazing clinician who works with people on their feelings. We talked to him about a month, maybe 6 weeks ago, and we didn't get through the entire set of feelings that he wanted sex addicts and their partners to know about. So I said, come back on the show, let's finish what we started, especially because tonight he's going to be talking about trust, shame, and, you know, the difference between guilt and shame. And how do you build trust and rebuild trust? And what books should you read? And what should you do? So I am really looking forward to interviewing him again. I think you'll find him delightful, very easy to understand, and he really makes a difference in the lives of sex addicts. Now I, on the other hand, really have made it my mission to bring to you the expertise of the best of the best. And I've been told, I've got a little secret, I've been told that Patrick Carnes is going to probably be on the show in the next couple of months. And personally, I would hope so. I mean, I trained with the man, for goodness sakes, and he's the best of the best. And so I really want him to come on the show and talk a little bit about the changes he's seen in the area of sexual addiction, what he believes to be true, and the path that he sees so many of his followers to be going in. And I'll tell you right now, it's all about neurobiology and the brain, neuroscience. So many of you think, oh, it's an act of willpower, or it's an act of morality or immorality. And Dr. Carnes would be here to say, you've trained your brain in a certain way, and now it involves untraining it and replacing it with healthy behaviors that create new neural circuitry in the brain. can't wait for him to be on the show. So I'll keep you posted. As soon as I have a date, I'll make sure to tell you. Because, you know, we all know Dr. Carnes is the guru of sexual addiction. He's written more books than anybody on the subject and has had some personal experiences with it, too. So can't wait to have the master himself on the show. Now, I have been getting a lot of emails, and, you know, I have to admit, many of these emails are about how to get healthy, what they need to do. And, you know, I talk about the recovery tools and the recovery points scale, and, you know, after the show, so many people will say, hey, how do I get that? And here's what I promise you. I promise that before the summer is over, I'm going to have those handouts on my website, www.sexhelpwithcarolthecoach.com, and they'll be available for downloads. That's my gift to you. But in the meantime, you can always email me at carolthecoach@aol.com. And I will send those to you. It may take me a couple of days, depending on how busy I am, but I never let it wait more than 72 hours. So hang in there with me. Feel free to get any help you need from me. I am your own personal life coach and psychotherapist helping you with this this issue that truly plagues you, your loved ones, your family. And I know it can feel unbearable. It's an epidemic, and you're not alone, and I'm here to help you. So you can always go to iTunes and put in Sexual Addiction or Carol the Coach and get every single one of my shows downloaded for free. And then if you want to take your life to the next level, you can also put in Carol the Coach, and you can pull up my Live Your Best Life show. And those are shows that are about conflict and how to deal with depression and how to be assertive and how to feel your feelings. You know, they're the life skills that we all need that we probably didn't get from our parents. And so those are two very different shows, but I highly recommend that you download them all. I have not done that Your Best Life show for a couple years. When I started doing this show, I stopped that show. And I have to tell you, they're good shows. I get a lot of feedback about, wow, Carol, you're one of my favorite coaches on iTunes. You give me such practical advice. So, again, I highly recommend that you look that up, too, and download it on your computer, download it on your iPod. And if you don't have access to your own computer, have your wife, your mother, your brother, your sister, put it on a little MP3 player. Go out there to Radio Shack or Best Buy and for $20, buy an MP3 player and just download it and listen to it when you're mowing the lawn or doing the dishes or washing the car. That's what I do. You know that my outer circle, my healthy behaviors, include very practical, I would never miss it, activities on a daily basis. I get up, I do my inspirational or recovery reading. Right now, I'm getting certified for EMDR, so I go to the computer and I tape myself going over the protocol. I'm a person of repetition. When I need to learn something, I need to read it over and over and over again. I need to speak it. I need to play it out. And then I do my exercising, and I listen to inspirational podcasts because I need that too. And then I start my day, and probably 5 to 10 times a day I talk about what is working. I talk about the gratitude. I want my vibrational energy to be as high as possible. And to do that means that I have to fill my emotional tank with positivity. And so when I do inspirational reading or I listen to people who talk about gratitude, You know, one of the best books that is not sexual addiction, but it's just in general, is The Complaint-Free World by Will Bowen. Challenges you not to make any complaints for 21 days, and for a sex addict or a partner, that is darn hard to do. And I'm always looking for something to improve my sense of self and my mental health, and I hope you will too. Like tonight, when we talk about feelings. So I'm going to introduce my guest right now. He really did a fabulous job of talking about feelings approximately, 6 weeks ago. And so I wanted to have him back on the show. Ken, welcome to the Sex Help with Carol the Coach show.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be back.
Yes, and you know, we had so much information. You gave us so much that we didn't get through it all. And all the feelings were so very important, but we left some of the best for last because they're the hardest to work on. So I just wondered if we could kind of review, if you will, just for about 5 minutes, the feelings mm-hmm. that we talked about last time. I've already instructed people to go back to the show that you were on to talk about, where you talked about anger and vulnerability and fear and stress. Now, mm-hmm. your take-home message about anger, what would you tell addicts and their partners about anger?
Well, you know, the thing that I watch most prominently is how people are victimized. They see themselves as victimized to their own anger. In other words, something happens out there and their felt sense is, well, what else could I do but act out angrily because you did X? And instead of recognizing that regardless of what you did, I am responsible for my own internal experiences and choosing a strategy that gets my needs met. And so to act out and then blame the other person victimizes me to that person. And so when people take that responsibility back of, look, I have to be responsible for the stress in my life and how I manage it, and the trigger thoughts and how I manage my own thought life, labeling, negative intent, magnification, those are things that I manage. And when I'm managing me well, that combustion into anger then decreases.
And, you know, obviously you had a formula that when anger equals stress plus trigger thoughts, which might be labeling,
right,
negative intent, magnification. And so if I've got a partner who's really angry, she feels betrayed, she's just found out about her husband's sexual addiction, anger
mm-hmm.
is normal, natural, and necessary. Wouldn't you agree?
I would. And I would
absolutely
also add,
but it's kind
maybe
of what she does with that anger that makes or breaks her. And so what would be some positive
correct
mechanisms that a partner who's just found out about her husband's sexual addiction, what could she think about this situation?
Yeah, well, you know, one thing is to kind of think about how anger is a secondary reactive emotion. It is oftentimes an umbrella emotion. Anger feels safer to offer than what I'm really feeling, which is hurt and betrayed. And so when people are able to get in touch with what they're feeling, as they peel back that layer of anger, what's really underneath this, oftentimes they're able to get connected to much deeper, much different emotional states. But anger as a primary emotion is very effective because when anger as a primary emotion is when somebody has a boundary violation. And so when somebody crosses over a healthy boundary, well, then anger is a natural response because anger backs people up. So clearly what the husband has done in his sexual acting out or sexual addiction is a boundary violation. And she's experiencing
mm-hmm.
that, and that's congruent with her integrous sense of self. You've crossed a line that is not okay with me, and therefore anger is a natural expression. And that, and if you remember, I quoted that one of my favorite quotes by Aristotle, that anybody can become angry. That's easy, but to be angry with the right person and to the right degree and at the right time and for the right purpose and in the right way, that's not within everybody's power, and it's not easy.
Well, absolutely. And if I understand you correctly, you're also saying that when anger occurs because of a boundary violation, it really can help us to decide, hey, what are our boundaries going to be and our consequences
mm-hmm.
if the boundaries are violated, so that we respect ourselves if
absolutely.
The respect didn't seem to occur in the coupleship.
Absolutely. Yep. And so that is a natural, normative emotion to experience when people encroach on a healthy boundary. And you know, one of the things that I and you probably work with this in your clients as well is how many people have grown up in families of origins that have told them, whether directly or indirectly, that their voice doesn't count, their voice doesn't matter, and they
uh-huh.
don't trust their own internal sense of self that says, hey, this is wrong.
Well, absolutely. And so that's where anger can be really useful and can help you to create a better sense of yourself by deciding how you're going to react to the situation that has hurt you. Now,
yeah.
Fear, I got such a kick out of this when you said fear is the other guest that is frequently in my office. So
mm-hmm.
say a little bit about what you feel fear does to our brains and our body.
Well, one of the books that I have just been delighted by and probably one of my top five favorite books is a book called Fear, or Understanding Fear in Self and Others by a delightful woman named Bonaroo Overstreet. And she's writing in 1951, so it's this, you know, sort of high writing in an earlier age when they actually expected people to work for their, you know, to read and stretch and grow. And her writing is just so delightful. But one of the chapters is there are fears to fear. Like, there is some stuff out there that's really scary stuff. And so much of what causes us so much pain is the machinations of fearing things that aren't, we don't need to fear, or that aren't really in front of us to scare us. It's the imaginings. And that's that internal self-work to be able to be firmly rooted in the reality that's in front of me. And if that's a scary reality, how do I embrace that? And if what I'm really doing is splitting to a fearful future, I'm leaving the moment that I'm in and I'm jumping to a fearful future, how do I acknowledge, yes, that fearful future would be hard, and now rewind back to my present? And that's that kind of mindful holding of the moment that says, okay, that would be hard and scary. What can I do now to fend that off or to change that future? But to come back to the now, because that splitting into the painful past and the fearful future steals from us the only moment that we have, which is now.
Well,
so
you're
fear
so
causes
right. You know,
go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, you know, one of the things I talk about is the three ways to increase your happiness factor is to have gratitude, to reframe and ask, how can I grow stronger from this, and to stay in the moment, which keeps you out of the past, and it has you not looking into the future. And I think that's why the 12-step program, One Day at a Time, is such a good motto to help people to cope. And you're saying that actually decreases the fear and keeps it in perspective.
Yeah, yeah, and helps you stay present with, okay, what is in front of me and how can I attend to that reality? You know, one of Patrick Carn's books, Out of the Shadows, he talks about that our sanity requires us to be rooted in reality, and that a sexual addiction, because addicts warp reality, that it disconnects us from reality. And so our sanity and maintaining that sanity really requires us to stay fully present with the reality that's in front of us. And sometimes
now, I have
those
to say,
really
you,
hard realities.
will you say that one more time? So this is a quote from Patrick Carnes, and it came from Out of the Shadows, and he says,
mm-hmm.
Our fantasy Say that again.
Our sanity requires us to be firmly rooted in reality. And that when we disconnect from reality, it deeply, negatively impacts our sanity. Mm-hmm. So if I'm not connected to what's in front of me, if I am through denial or sincere delusions or lies or whatever way I'm using to twist reality, if I'm disconnecting from reality, then it really negatively impacts my sanity.
Well, I believe that. We see that every day in our office, too. And, of course, that kind of stuff creates us more and more stress. And certainly, whenever you're dealing with sexual addiction, whether you're the addict, him or herself, or the partner, stress is kind of a natural and normal reaction to the discovery of sexual addiction, the fears that go along with that, the anger, the betrayal. So tell us a little bit about what you believe some of the causes of unmanaged stress. What happens to the body? What does cortisol do?
Well, cortisol is our body's main stress hormone. So when we're having a fight, flight, or freeze response to something that is stressful or scary or potentially traumatizing in front of us, cortisol is one of our body's main stress hormones, and it's absolutely an effective and necessary hormone. It galvanizes all of our resources to focus on the threat and trauma in front of us, and that is only meant to be in a short burst. We're not meant to live in a chronic state of stress. And so when we are living in a chronic state of stress, it seriously impacts our body systems just one after another. So in an acute burst of stress, part of what cortisol releases is it causes the body to start pulling fats out of the fat lockers for available long-term fuel burning, which is great. But if I'm in a chronic state of stress, then that extra fat in my bloodstream now begins to cause arteriosclerosis. It pulls out glucagon out of the liver so that there's more available blood sugar for our muscles that are now either fighting the bear or running from the bear. That's great if that's 3 minutes. But if that's a chronic state, well, then I may now acquire diabetes. It ravages a part of the brain called the hippocampus, which helps with memory. It takes an experience and integrates it into new neuronal connections, and it disrupts those neuronal connections. So my memory is shot in a stage of long-term chronic stress, and it causes our GI tract to shut down, because in 3 minutes of terrified running from the bear, you know, I don't need to be digesting my cheeseburger. And so that's great if it's 3 minutes, but if it's in a chronic state, 80% of our immune system comes from our gut. So if my gut is impaired, then I'm susceptible to diseases. My cuts don't heal well. I begin to age. My skin looks older. So cortisol is ravaging to our bodies in long-term stressful situations.
Okay, so now you had talked about a good book called Deadly Emotions by Dr. Don Colbert, who is a Christian, and so we want to say that right up front. But he really talks about how to deal with stress and how stress can play itself out in your mind and in your body.
Yeah. Yeah. And one of the things that I love that he articulates in his book is how much stress is completely determined by our perspective and what we determine to be stressful. You know, one person may get absolutely freaked out by an informal dinner party for six, and another person may be absolutely delighted by a formal dinner party for 40. Well, there's nothing inherently stressful about a dinner party. It's my perspective of the dinner party that then makes it stressful or not stressful. And so once I determine that something is stressful, it begins to create a drag on the system. And so if you've ever had a really stressful day, you get to the end of your day and you just feel exhausted. When I have to do paperwork paperwork is one of those. You may be delighted by paperwork, Carol. I am not. And you and I both know that our practices and our worlds have a lot of paperwork. So that's one of those things that I have to consciously choose to frame my paperwork in a way that doesn't just deplete me of energy. So I have to go to great extents. I have to, you know, have my favorite cup of coffee. I have to have some wonderful music that I'm listening to because I really need to stack the deck because I am not a fan of paperwork. So, but it's a drag in my system because of my perspective of it. Now, my wife, who is very, very linear, and she loves filling in things and blocks and Quicken is her best friend, which I love about her, she would be delighted by paperwork.
And so, obviously, again, that for her is something that she looks forward to, and for you, it's something that you have to create support around to actually make it more tolerable or even more pleasant.
Absolutely. As an off-the-charts extrovert, I'm routinely speaking to large groups of people. My wife, who's an off-the-chart introvert, that would eat her lunch. She would be so drained just by the thought of that. But once again, there's nothing inherently stressful about a group of people. It's completely our perspective of it. So we have to be mindful of what are the narratives that we're living under, what are the meanings that we're giving to things, and sometimes what we'll find out is those meanings are family heirlooms. They're things that our people gave to us that maybe we don't want to live under the tyranny of that message anymore. I was just sitting with a client couple right before we got on the phone, and one of the narratives, she's had an affair. He's deeply wounded. It happened to be with his best friend, and they're working through it, and they're doing the work, and they are recovering from this. And I asked him today, I said, how do you like to be comforted? And he said, well, I like to, you know, be touched. I like to be held. I like to be – and she stopped, and she says – you've never asked me to hold you. And he says, well, men don't do that. So here's this narrative that he was living under that says men don't ask to be held and to have their needs met, which meant that he wasn't getting his needs met. And she was totally willing to do it, and he wanted it, but his narrative said men don't do that. So then he didn't ask for it.
So hence, again, it's so important for us to identify our feelings and then with our loved ones, at least express what we believe we need. It doesn't mean we'll get it. And certainly,
right.
I'm sure you've heard the love languages. Oftentimes, if
yes.
someone's going to give you love, they do it in the love language they enjoy as opposed to your love language. But that was certainly a classic example, your couple, of him not really believing that he deserved to ask for that to be met.
Yep, and that was traced all the way back to the narrative that his father gave him about men. Men are emotionally disconnected. Men are stoic and withhold, and they don't ask for their needs to be met. If you ask for your needs to be met, then your manhood card is in question.
Okay.
And so once he was confronted with that, and he kind of wrestled with that in session, it was delightful to watch him realize, I don't want that narrative. That's not what I believe. It's not congruent with his Christian faith, and it's not what he wants to live by. And so he was like, you'd really hold me? Of course I would love that. And I said, would you like to just take a second and try? Ask her. And so he did, and she did, and it was this delightful connection of like, wow, I can really ask for my needs to be met? Yes, you really can.
Oh, absolutely. Now, tonight, we're going to be talking about shame and trust and vulnerability. So let's talk a little bit about shame. How would you describe shame?
So it's important to separate the difference between shame and guilt. Shame is about who I am as a person. Guilt is about what I've done. So guilt is about behavior. It's about this is who I see myself to be, and I'm doing something that's not congruent with who I want to be or who I see myself to be. But it's about behavior. It's about out there. And shame or guilt can be a wonderful fuel that propels you into repentance and change and growth and ownership and making amends. Shame, however, causes us to shrink back because it's me that's bad and wrong, and so I want to hide and divide. I want to hide my shamefulness and push away so that people don't see my bad, flawed, unworthy self.
Okay, so much of what you have had to deal with in your sessions is linked directly to how people see themselves and the thoughts they have, the things they say to themselves. And obviously our clients oftentimes get that from their childhood of origin, so that they actually do see themselves as bad, flawed, and worthless.
Absolutely.
You really recommend Brené Brown and her work to kind of combat shame and vulnerability. Yeah, say a little bit about her.
Oh, she's this wonderful, smart aleck, West Texas gal, just delightful. She's a professor at the University of Houston, and she's been researching shame and vulnerability for the last, I don't know, 13, 14 years. She did a TED Talk, and I believe it was 2011, that went supernova, and then she's come out with a flurry of books based on all of her research, The Gifts of Imperfection, Men, Women, and Worthiness, Daring Greatly, The Power of Vulnerability. And they're just delightful. And for your listeners, I would recommend that they get them at Audible or iTunes and listen to her do her stuff. You'll get so much more out of it than if you read it, just because of how wonderful she is in narrating her own stuff. And but one of the things that I remember that she had said about shame is that the three things that shame needs to grow is silence, secrecy, and judgment. And that the metaphor that she uses is if you put shame in a petri dish with these three things, that shame would just flourish, it would grow up your arm into every crevice of your life. But the one thing that is completely inhospitable to shame is empathy. That when you open those crappy, ugly, gross parts of yourself to another person, like I do routinely to my wife and to my closest friends, and what I'm met with is, wow, I get it, man. I understand that. I've been there. I've done that. That makes sense to me. I know how hard that is. And what I'm met with is, me too. I'll join you in that place. Instead of, oh, man, that looks bad. Oh, boy, that really sucks. Which is not empathy, but, what would be a better word for it? Sympathy. Oh,
uh-huh.
That looks bad.
Uh-huh.
Instead of, I know how bad that feels, and I'll join you in that space. But in order to experience empathy in that way, I have to be willing to be vulnerable. I have to be willing to risk and open myself. And here's the thing. When you go back to that couple that I was working with, in this profound betrayal of not just an affair, but with an affair with a best friend, and here they are working on trust, but there's no way to build trust without risk. So here he had experienced this profound betrayal by his wife, and he turns to her and says, would you hold me? And she said, I would love to. I mean, that's really vulnerable. I'm turning to the person who's just wounded me, and I'm asking for her to be part of my healing process.
Oh, yeah,
and
absolutely.
She's more
powerful.
Than willing. She's all in. Yeah.
So then, clearly, vulnerability is the key to developing trust because it's that
mm-hmm.
risk-taking involved. And, you know, so many of the people that we deal with have been so hurt. Vulnerability is very, very tough. That's why sometimes it's the first time they get to actually practice it is within the constraints of our office where they see that there's going to be a witness that's going to make sure that things are handled properly.
Yep. And so both people have to play their parts in that trust building. One person has
mm-hmm.
to be willing to risk, but the other person has to meet that risk with respect. And if I'm willing to risk at this level, and you meet me at this level with respect, then I'm sort of at a crossroads. Do I just hold? Is this as far as I'm going to go? Or do I now risk greater? And then do you meet me with respect? And then do I risk greater? But these are kind of epigenic risking. They build upon each other. That my next risk is predicated on this risk. And if I risk with you and you don't meet me with respect, well, then I don't risk higher. And where I watch a lot of my clients who don't have a good sense of boundaries for themselves or a good sense of breaking is they'll risk, their partner doesn't meet them with respect, and then their next move is, oh, you didn't see that, let me risk higher. And then they don't get met with respect, and then they go higher. And the whole time their partner is signaling to them, I'm not able or willing to meet you with respect here, and they refuse to see it, and they keep going up instead of recognizing, oh, you're showing me something here, and I need to pay attention to this.
Well, you know, it can be very, very difficult when people have been hurt so badly to take that first step. So what do you advise to your clients in terms of building trust and becoming more vulnerable? What can they do that can keep them feeling safe but also taking the risk?
Well, the lens that I look through is that of an attachment theorist. So attachment theory really drives a lot of the work that I'm doing, which is why I certainly did not mean to be the affair guy in Kansas City, but simply because the tool set that I have is when people have profoundly damaged their trust in their relationship, oftentimes they didn't mindfully build this trust. It just sort of happened subconsciously. And now that this the fabric of their we has been ripped apart by an affair or sexual acting out or an addiction or whatever it is, they don't know how to fix it. They don't know how to strand by strand, line by line, re-knit the fabric of trust that's lost. So when you think about the attachment bond and how that is built, it really requires three things. It requires the willingness to access another person and say, ow, that hurt me. It requires the other person to respond back in a timely and competent manner that sends a meta message of, I care about your pain, and I'm here for your pain. And then it requires the emotional engaging of the it, whatever that it is that's been put on the table, to engage it, and in the engagement, knit one more strand. And so the fundamental question of all significant relationships is, can I count on you? When I'm wounded, can I count on you to reach to you, to reach back? When I need your help, can I count on you to be there? And attachment theory really looks at two primary places where attachment fabric is knit, of pain and gain. And so to really be, so when my daughter, you know, wins state basketball, my butt better be in the bleachers. And when her boyfriend breaks up with her, I better cancel my clients that week, you know, her that day, and really attend to her if that was a very significant relationship. Because both of those points are attachment points. When she needs me, and how I respond to that need and how we engage that is going to knit huge cables into the fabric of our trust.
Well, that's interesting that you would call that fabric of our trust, because that's exactly right, and it's all interwoven. And obviously, anybody can rebuild trust. But in doing so, they have to have the tools to do it. Now, you talk about the attachment bond, and you say there are three things: access, responsiveness, and emotionally engaging the it, whatever the it is. So you're really saying, can I count on you?
Yeah. Yeah. So I've got a five-month-old, little Caleb Gabriel, delightful little boy. So when he cries in his crib, he's accessing me. It's his way. It's the only way mechanism that he has to say, "Hey, Dad, I've got a problem." So how I come in and respond to him really matters, because I could come in, "What? Why are you crying? Shut up!" I mean, that is a response. But if that's the response that he gets to me over time, then that's going to decrease the probability of him reaching to me. So when I come in and my response to him is, hey, buddy, it's okay. What's going on? And then I run the traps. Is he hot? Is he caught on something? Does he have a poopy diaper? Is he hungry? Is he cold? Is he warm? You know, and I, in a timely and competent manner, figure out what his need is. Oh, I think he's hungry. And I make a bottle and I feed him. And sure enough, there it is. And he dozes off in that milk coma. And he goes right back to sleep and he's fine. That whole process of him accessing me, me responding, us emotionally engaging, sends that signal to him of I can count on you, so that when he needs me again in the future, the propensity for him to reach will go up, 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 up through our relationship. But if I come in to you know, him accessing me, that I have a problem, and I'm responsive and I'm timely, but let's say I'm not competent. He's starving, and I come in and go, oh, he must be cold, and I put a blanket on. See, in my lack of competency, what I'm going to teach him over time is, this guy's really nice, but he doesn't meet my needs, and so I stop reaching to him. So for spouses, the imperative is that we move immediately when our spouse is hurting or needs us, and that if we don't know what to do, we ask, sweetheart, I really want to love you right now, and I don't know what you need. What do you need from me right now? And then we move heaven and earth to meet that need.
Well, again, that is the risk. That's the vulnerability. And that's what I would encourage my listeners to do, because truly asking is the first step to vulnerability and to possibly getting your needs met and to creating that intimacy that everybody really wants. You know, sexual addiction is considered an intimacy disorder. Tonight in my group, I heard a guy say, well, you call it an intimacy disorder. I call it a connection dysfunction. And we're both saying the exact same thing, that, you know, truly, which came first, the connection dysfunction or the sexual addiction? Well, more than likely, the connection dysfunction occurred in childhood, just like you said. If a parent had come in and screamed at the baby for wanting the blanket or for crying, the child would learn early on that it isn't safe to ask. And then that, of course, transfers as they get older, and then they learn how to meet their own needs, and then they do that in dysfunctional ways. They act out, they do porn, whatever. And then that, of course, pushes their spouse or their loved one away.
Yep. And there's some wonderful books. Once again, I look through a Christian lens. There's a book called Attachments by Clinton and Sibsey that do a phenomenal job of looking backwards on family of origin stuff and then into the present and helping process some of those things to help people figure out, do I look through a secure attachment, an avoidant attachment, a disorganized attachment, or an anxious attachment? There's some books by Dan Siegel called Parenting from the Inside Out. So if you are currently a parent and you want to understand what was my attachment style, and here's the thing that got me in my master's program, with 86% predictability, if you know what attachment style you had with your parents, then with 86% predictability, you know what attachment style you'll have with your children, because that's the lens that you're going to parent through. So, you know, the good news is those attachment lenses can be changed. You can earn a secure attachment. So I didn't come out with a secure attachment. I came out with an avoidant attachment style. And so that really negatively impacted my relationships my whole life because I didn't privilege emotional connection. And so I had to learn late in life how to tolerate the discomfort that comes with intimacy. But it's doable. It can be done. And Dan Siegel is a wonderful guide in that. Clinton and Sibsey in their book Attachments is fantastic. So there's lots of stuff out there on attachment theory that's very easily accessible to people that aren't therapists and just lay people.
Well, I appreciate that. I appreciate hearing about the books because clearly, you know, you can be working with a good therapist and then, in addition, speeding up some of the recovery and the understanding by repetition. And I was saying before you got on the call that it is so important to learn via repetition because that's when you really get it. And so These sound like excellent books to reinforce what a client may be doing in their therapy or in their support group or in their 12-step work. And you sound
and
like an avid reader.
Well, I am. And, you know, one of the things that my clients come to either love or hate about me is I require that work of them as well. Because my job is to fire myself as quickly as possible. And if people are hiring me to spoon-feed every book I've read to them in session and to do the work of life change in session, then I'm going to be part of their life until I'm 80. So that's a non-starter for me. So it is required by me, if they're going to work with me, to not only read, but to do audiobooks as well and capture their drive time, their gym time, their lawn time, and to be bathing in Dan Siegel's words or, you know, When Anger Hurts, and just other resources, because they've got to open themselves to better tools. And if they're only – I book in two-hour blocks. So if they're only seeing – you know, if they're only getting 2 hours of new information, well, that's not enough. And so they've got to open themselves on multiple different levels throughout their week to keep that reinforcement and that ball going. At least that's my view. So part of the process of working with me is people really get to love books and audiobooks.
Well, that's interesting that you would say that, because before you came on the show again, I said that not only do I read things, but I listen to them after the fact, because I want that repetition and I want that reinforcement. And let's face it, you hear something different every time you listen to it, or you read something different every time you look at it.
Absolutely. So there's an audiobook I have by Dan Siegel called The Neurobiology of We, and I've probably listened to it 8 times. I just love bathing in that wisdom when I'm out digging a hole and planting a bush in my yard or whatever it is. It's just delightful to me to constantly be reinforced by those powerful tools and concepts, and super important. And one of the things, and maybe you disciplined yourself early on with this as well, is I never read a book for my clients. I always read for me. And in the process, I'm reading and sort of mining out of these books, what is in here for me? How can I be a better lover of my wife, my children, my friends, my clients, myself, the world at large? So everything I read always drives to the now what. So if I'm going to underline something, there's at least some part of my brain that's saying, wow, that's really cool. What do I do with this now? Like, how does this now practically and demonstrably change me? And I have to really help my clients to discipline themselves to read in that way, because too often they'll start reading a book for their spouse. And what they're underlining is all of the evidence that they are then going to leave on their spouse's pillow for them to see, of evidence of, see, you really are a crappy person. And if you're reading for somebody else, then you miss all of the stuff that's there for you. And so you really I really encourage my clients to read in the first person. Funnel this through your heart and your life. Don't read for your spouse.
Well, I must apologize. That has never happened to me. The call just dropped. And poor Ken, he's probably wondering what in the heck has happened. So we only really have 5 more minutes to the show. Ken, if you're listening, please feel free to call back. 646-595-3284. And actually, I'm going to get you back on the phone, Ken. So, I don't know that I can do that. I hope that you enjoyed the show. That I'm just kind of floored that call just dropped like that. We were talking about feelings, how to build trust, how to deal with shame. And let's face it, it's important to know how to use these feelings to become more authentic and to know yourself better to motivate you to make the changes that you need to. So I'm going to encourage you all to get a hold of Ken. He is a man who really works hard at helping his clients to be as healthy as possible. And I would go back to his original show, and if I can, I'm going to tell you when that was, because I'd like for you to listen to the beginning of it. It was on 2/16/15, so it was 2 days after Valentine's Day. Go back, listen to that show, and you can reach Ken at his counseling center, ken@aspen-kc.com. Again, that's Ken at Aspen, aspen-kc.com. If you have any questions about feelings, if you want to take a look at his website, he'll direct you there. This is a man who has spent a lot of time helping his clients to get happy, healthy, and of course, grow wiser. So, next week, we're going to be talking to an addict who is going to talk about what it's like to be young, and he's 32 years of age, and to have gotten out of treatment and to want his life different, and what he's doing to make that happen. He's a real inspiration. He's working really tough and hard. If you are a client that want to be on the show, you can email me at carolthecoach@aol.com, and I will be happy to get you scheduled. Of course, I kind of have to interview you, make sure you're healthy and you're going to be saying things that I think are advantageous for our listeners. But you know what? I know they will be, because clearly I learn as much from my clients as they learn from me. We all teach each other. That's the name of the game in life. So, as I say at the end of every show, you know, there will only be one of you at all times. So fearlessly have the courage to be yourself. And I want you to have a good week. We'll connect next Monday at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for more Sex Health. Great week.